Hello, welcome to the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. We were having a microphone issue here.
We had a little bit of dead air time. That's not good.
I'm having to hold up the microphone. And anyway, so we're glad you're joining us for the conversation. We have an hour with Dan Drost, and that should excite just about anybody, having Dan Drost on the program, because he knows pretty much everything. So call with your questions or comments at 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also reach us at our Gmail address. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. And I hope that you'll also follow us on Twitter. It's at hashtag zestygarden is to send your questions, or at zestygarden to follow us. But we'd love to have you in on our conversation. Dan, thanks for coming in.
It's good to be here again. It's looks like it's going to warm up, and it might be excessively warm next week. So, you know, this is Utah. You know, you go from the cold. I had hail coming down yesterday at my house, and, you know, it wasn't a lot, but, you know, it's one of those little things that you just kind of go, oh, I hope the garden gets through this if it's really hard. And then, you know, on the news, I watched the weather, and they showed some pictures from somewhere in central Utah that the man had taken a picture in his backyard, and it was completely white, and it was hail. I mean, can you imagine how much hail to make your whole lawn white? I mean, you couldn't see grass. And so, you know, that's a springtime in Utah, so we're at that, and we need to, you know, kind of talk about what we can do to, you know, plow our way through these kinds of anomalies.
Well, let's talk about going from cool to hot. What do you have to be concerned about?
Well, I think a couple things that, you know, if it just turns straight heat, you know, then certainly for many of our warm season vegetables, you know, that's a good thing, because we really want to get those warm season crops in the ground. And here we are in early May, and I know some people have already started to put out their tomatoes and their peppers and those kinds of things, and, you know, they like to get a jump on it. But if they put them under some plastic, or if they got them in a wall of water, or if you have a hot cap out there, and today the temperature is 60, one of the rules that I tell my students is that you need to remember what I call the 30-plus rule. And the 30-plus rule is really straightforward. It says that whatever your outdoor temperature is, inside a greenhouse, inside a hot cap, inside a wall of water, what you're looking at is 30 degrees warmer than the outdoor temperature. So ideally, if it turns really hot on us and we get some temperatures that are in the mid-70s to upper 70s, then essentially what we're going to be doing is we're going to be roasting things.
And, okay, sorry, I'm still trying to
fix this
microphone.
I know, you're still working on your mic over here, but we'll get that fixed. So
so with that 30-degree difference, if it were to be, you know, when it jumps up, how much is it going to burn those plants?
Well,
if you don't let the heat out of the top.
Well, plants function best in kind of a broad range of temperatures. So our cool season vegetables, you know, we can get those things to germinate when the temperature is, you know, in and around 40 degrees. So at soil temperatures that are 40, they'll start to germinate. And it's fairly slow, but it'll happen. And then they function best up until about 70 or 75 degrees. So that's our cool weather crops. Now, if it goes to 75, we've been doing some work on monitoring temperatures right at the ground surface. The temperature at the ground surface might be another 30 degrees warmer than that. So right at the ground surface, you could say, I'm planting lettuce this weekend, and now 70 is kind of the upper threshold, or 75 is the upper threshold for that plant to function, both to germinate and to grow effectively. Now at ground level, I'm already up to over 100 degrees, and that really puts some stress on those plants. A, it won't germinate, or B, it just doesn't grow as well.
Well, I was having a discussion with a group of new friends that I had from North Logan last night, and this was one of the things that we had discussed was – knowing when to stop planting some things and when to get started on the others.
Right.
And I said, don't even think about planting peas right now.
Yeah, it's much too late.
They'll germinate, but they're not gonna grow. You're gonna get low-growing plants, and you'll get some pods, but you won't get very much. It's not worth the effort.
That's right. And that has to do with, you know, how plants respond to all of the different temperatures that the plant is going to experience over the full range of its life. So we're talking about germination. You know, for some plants, like lettuce plants, what we end up seeing is that if we get soils that are too warm, they don't germinate because we get into this phenomena called thermodormancy. And so that tends to be a problem for us. Now, if the lettuce plants do get up and they're relatively small, then you have the issue of just how the plants respond to high temperatures as it's trying to grow its leaves, and that can be problematic. And then if that plant is getting close to maturing, where you're going to be start harvesting the leaves, if we have these really high temperatures, then the plant produces more secondary compounds in the leaf that may give it some off flavors. And sometimes we see that when we get into the heat of summer, that the lettuce tends to be a little bit on the bitter side. We have a little stronger flavor in our cabbage and in our broccoli. And those are all heat-related phenomena that are just associated with how the plant copes with these conditions. So, you know, we run through these cycles of warmer, colder, those kinds of things. That's just part and parcel of what we have to deal with. And I can't really predict how warm it's going to be next week. The forecasters say, well, it's going to be pretty warm. We might be above normal. Our normal temperatures up in the valley here are, you know, in the mid, you know, low 70s might be a kind of a normal, high 60s, low 70s. Well, if we're up almost to 80 or beyond, that's probably not too problematic for the plants. But if that continues, that's going to affect how some of these cooler season crops grow. And so you're not going to get as much productivity out of them. Now, in contrast to that, our warm season crops, those are the kinds of temperatures that we want. These plants function best at temperatures between, you know, they start to really grow at 60, so, you know, we're just barely getting to that, and then we're dropping kind of cool at night. Well, if the day temperatures are getting up into the mid-70s, the mid-80s, your tomatoes like that, your peppers like that, your squash likes that, your cantaloupes like that, and all of those plants start to grow really vigorously because you're in their optimal window of temperature. And so, you know, that's why we generally don't recommend that you start planting things like tomatoes and peppers until, you know, maybe the 10th of May here in the valley, and particularly if you can give them some protection. But by the same token, you need to understand that if the temperature goes way in excess of what the ideal is for those crops, then you're going to also run into secondary problems as well. And generally, we see those problems occur when we decide to use a hot cap or when we put a plant underneath a wall of water and we don't ventilate it during the day. You know, you just close it up at night, or it's closed up when you put the plant in there, and you kind of walk away from it, and you expect a few weeks from now, I'm going to come back and I'm going to remove this. And then you say, well, this plant is kind of growing inside there, but it really doesn't look that good. And you think to yourself, it should have flowers on it by now. How come it doesn't have flowers? Well, leaves can tolerate the heat a lot more than the fruiting structures do. And we need those flowers to produce a tomato fruit or a pepper fruit or a watermelon fruit. And so you have to really kind of regulate it, not only for the whole plant, but for the particular part that you're interested in.
So what do you do for the cruciferous type vegetables, such as broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts? You can't just grow them in the cool season of the year. They take all summer to grow, but you don't want them to get those sulfury tasting compounds, especially Brussels sprouts. So is this where you do a mulch to keep the roots cool?
Yeah, what you're trying to do is, you know, just to compensate as best you can. And, you know, ideally cabbage does fairly well, and you find that, you know, there are summer type of cabbage and there are summer types of broccoli. Those names that they attach to the description that go with the particular variety are often ones that will tolerate a little bit higher temperatures and still perform adequately. So you need to kind of look around. You got to read some labels. That's why we always talk about in the late fall and in the early spring sessions when we get on the radio here to look at seed catalogs and kind of try and identify varieties that may have those characteristics. And if you purchase locally, oftentimes the seed sellers and the plant sellers, you know, have selected types over the years that have performed better under local conditions because they've kind of learned. And yet the job of the listener here today is to also, you know, kind of expand their understanding of it, not only just rely on what you get from somebody, but to do a little bit of experimentation yourself, you know, to try some new varieties from time to time. And I know you're one of those types of people because what you're trying to do is say, okay, for the unique environment that I live in, the soils that I have, the microclimate that's Hyde Park in your case, or the microclimate that's Wellsville, or the microclimate that's, wherever, Springdale, you need to find things that are more adapted to those types of conditions. And because we have so many varieties out there, it's easy for us to look at the full spectra of plant material and say to ourselves, oh, this broccoli variety says it tolerates the heat more. So down in Springdale, I'm going to try that one because it's going to perform a little bit better. And for you, you may say, well, I don't have that warm of an environment. I live in a little bit of a cooler area. I have X, Y, and Z in my garden, a little bit of shade, and I kind of put them in there, and that gives me some, you know, better growth on these plants, and therefore the plants function better.
So when they say grows better in the heat, I mean, that could, to me, that could mean a whole lot of things. Maybe it only tolerates 1 or 2 degrees hotter than the average.
You're absolutely right. And that's, you know, kind
of... That's where your trial and error
comes
along.
That's where your trial comes in. And, you know, last year was one type of year, and this year is another type of year, and next year is a different one again. And, you know, that's what keeps gardening both interesting and frustrating. You know, it just makes it, you know, a little bit harder for me as a specialist to say, grow this one. And that's why I never do that. I never tell anyone what plant they should grow because I know enough that there's so many unique varieties out there and they are adapted to different types of conditions. And you have to kind of look at your particular conditions and you have to know your environment. That's the first clue to being a successful gardener.
So when I tell you, well, I'm going to try growing peanuts, you never say, don't grow peanuts, but you might say, good luck.
Well, I had somebody ask me that the other day. I was walking across campus and somebody said to me, oh, Dr. Drost, you know, remember when we did this together? And I got a call from a sushi bar in Ogden, and they saw our online publication about growing wasabi, and they wanted to grow wasabi. And I had to kind of tell them that, well, you know, it was kind of a intellectual exercise for us to develop this fact sheet that said to grow wasabi in the garden, what you need to do. It said, and so he asked me some very specific questions. I told him I'd get back to him on this information, and what we did is, you know, looked around as, are there any commercial wasabi growers in the United States? Well, there's one little valley up in Oregon that there are a few growers that are starting to grow it and doing it reasonably successful because it has such unique environmental conditions that are necessary to grow the plant. Now, how could we do that in Utah? It would be really difficult to maybe do it on a large commercial scale, but on a smaller scale, we might be able to create conditions that are more possible. And because wasabi actually grows on stream banks in the wild, it needs moist or wet roots all the time. So we were thinking, oh, if you had a water feature in your garden, you could put it in a pot. You could lay the pot right next to your water feature, have the bottom of the pot up into the water itself so that it's constantly being bathed by the cool water that's there. And then, you know, it's all of these other things that you need to do. And so hopefully at the end of the year, you got some of that root that grew off of that plant and you could then grind it to create your wasabi sauce for whatever you're going to use this for. And so, I mean, there are creative ways that you can do these things, but it still comes back to understanding the plant, what the plant requires, what its environmental conditions are, which are temperature, moisture, nutrition, light, heat, all of those kinds of things. And then, you know, saying to myself, well, how's my environment? You said, well, could we grow peanuts here in the valley? Absolutely. Do you get a lot of peanuts out of them? Probably not. What could I do to get more peanuts from these? Well, I need to create a warmer environment for them. I need to create a longer growing season because most peanuts require at least 120 days, but more like 150 of frost-free. And by frost-free, what we're really talking about is temperatures that are above 50 degrees
for 150 days.
That's your average daily temperature. Now, how often does that happen in Cache County? It doesn't, but there are ways to do it. You know, if you are dead on it, oh, I could probably put them in my high tunnels, grow them there, put my covers back over them September, let them grow some more, and I probably could meet that 150 days of 50 degrees or warmer and be able to have a reasonably nice peanut crop. And knowing, I've got to go to a lot of expense to go do that,
yeah.
But it's something that I can
do. And knowing me, it's like, okay, I've got that out of my system. What's the next thing I
That's
can
right.
try?
That's right. And so, you know, just being a little bit clever about things can really, you know, you can do just about anything here. You can grow just about anything here. That's what I tell people. You just need to know what it requires, and then you have to sometimes go to extraordinary lengths to have it done, and that's fine. I mean, I like to see people that come to me and say, I grew sweet potatoes. In fact, I have a farmer down in Layton now who grows sweet potatoes every year, and he never thought he could do it. But people kept asking him, well, you have regular potatoes. Do you have sweet potatoes? And so one year we said, let's try it. And now he's gone, and he grows maybe a half an acre of sweet potatoes.
Wow, really?
Yeah, and he says it's not high production, but he says my customers like it at the farmer's market.
It's because it's locally grown.
It's local. It's something they're used to, and I say they get a kick out of it. They pay me a lot of money for these things, and so I'm happy. They're happy. You know, why not? And you know, so we just had to work out a system for them to do that. And so everything can be done. I could grow citrus here. I'll grow it in a pot. I'll move it inside. I'll move it outside. You know, I have a bougainvillea that's been growing for almost 15 years. And I just have it in a container, and it goes out on my patio. Probably will go out in about 10 days. And then it comes back in September, and it's inside. It just finished blooming indoors, so it's done blooming from the indoor crop. Now it'll go on the patio. I'll prune it back. It'll put out all this new growth, and then it'll bloom again in late July. And so I get two bloom cycles out of it a year. And it looks nice, and people are like, what kind of plant is that? How can you do that? Well, you know, it's knowing its environment and then treating it accordingly.
I know I've eaten an orange and a lemon grown in Utah.
Yeah.
And just a half a block from my house.
Yeah. So it can happen.
But it takes some work.
It takes some work. And you just have to learn. And you have to, like you say, have a passion for these things. And, you know, there's a lot of people that will have a passion for a carrot. That's fine. You know, it's not hard to grow a carrot here. And it's usually one of those crops that I suggest to people. You know, some of the easiest things to grow are things like carrots and lettuce and onion and a few of those things. You know, they're not the most exotic or exciting or of crops. But
wait, there are so many different varieties of carrots.
Absolutely. And there's so many different colors. I mean, you can get purple ones and red ones and white ones and orange ones and some of them that are, you know, a mix of those things, because this is what people want. And now when you display those, you know, people go, wow, you did that? You know, so it's just a carrot. Come on, you know, it's not that exciting. But, you know, people get excited about that stuff. And you can be excited about it, too. And then what you do is you branch out from there, and then you try things that are a little bit more difficult. And you know, before you know it, you know, you're an expert gardener. That's what we're really trying to accomplish.
When you're growing something like that that looks exotic, but it's not that hard to grow, like bright lights, chard, people think, oh, he really knows what he's doing. And it's like, all I did was plant the seed. But here's this fluorescent yellow, fluorescent red, fluorescent orange stalks on this chard, and it just looks really cool.
It is. And, you know, to me, that's that's exciting, you know, and that gets people excited. And gardening is all about, you know, kind of a change of doing something. You know, it's real easy for us to go home, you know, hit the start button on the TV or get back on the computer and, you know, do whatever. But, you know, you get out in the air, you do something with your kids, you know, you do something with your spouse. You know, it's some quiet time. It's some reflective time. It's just, you know, in many ways, it's a religious experience, and I think a gardening is. You know, it's just kind of, you know, just kind of gets back to where our roots are, because we're agrarians by, you know, birth, basically, you know, historically in the long term. And so this is a chance for us to, you know, smell the earth and breathe air and, you know, see plants grow and enjoy flowers and, you know, enjoy the fruits of our labor, so to speak, as the Bible says. You know, it's not a bad thing. And it's certainly more healthy for us when we eat healthy and when we exercise and do all those kinds of things.
Well, we've almost reached the halfway point of our program already.
How does this happen?
Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. He'll be with me for the entire hour. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or tweet us a question. It's #ZestyGarden. Well, we're going to go for a quick break, but we'll be right back with the rest of the program, so stay tuned.
Preserve the flavor and nutrition of asparagus to enjoy year-round. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. This flavorful vegetable is low in calories and high in vitamins A and C, as well as fiber. Unfortunately, it's most readily available and at the best price in the spring. Ensure the best flavor with proper harvesting. Select young tender spears 8 to 10 inches tall. Wash and remove the ends, then cut to fit the freezer bag or container. Blanch the asparagus before freezing to lock in flavor, color, and texture. Dip the asparagus into boiling water. You'll need a large pan with a lid. Blanch small spears for 2 minutes, medium spears for 3, and large spears for 4 minutes. Remove and immediately set the blanched spears in ice water for 5 minutes to cool. Drain and freeze. And if you don't have an asparagus patch, consider planting one this year. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Welcome back to the second half of the Zesty Garden. And in our gardening calendar, there's a couple of things coming up. Red Butte Garden in Salt Lake is you can spend the afternoon creating a unique combination of plants that you can take home and enjoy as it becomes your own living flower arrangement. It's held in their greenhouse facility, and this workshop covers the ins and outs of layering bulbs to create living flower arrangements, as well as which bulb cultivars are best suited for containers. And registration is required. Go online at redbuttegarden.org. It's this Saturday from 10 to 1 p.m. They are also having, Wasatch Community Gardens is having their annual plant sale. This thing is huge. It is at Roland Hall School parking lot. It's at 720 South Guardsman Way in Salt Lake. It says that the sale will offer more than 30,000 plants. Have you been to this before?
Yes, I have, and I don't go back because it is sheer chaos.
Everybody running to get what they want.
Yeah, but it's a lot of fun, and they do a wonderful job, and there's just a nice selection of things. So if
heirloom
you're down,
tomatoes,
if you're down
starch,
Salt Lake Way, you know, just pop in on Saturday.
Herbs, water-wise plants.
Go early for the good stuff.
Yeah, go early. There is an All About Herbs workshop on the 18th. Let's see, the community garden plant sale is this Saturday. The workshop for herbs is next Saturday, the 18th, from 10 to 11 at the Tahnequint Nature Center, 1851 South Dixie Drive in St. George. And then there's a plant propagation series at the Utah State University Botanical Center in Kaysville. And it's every Thursday from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Then in Iron County, there's a composting workshop on June the 8th at the Iron County Visitor Center. Jumpstart your landscape with some homemade compost. Information is at 586-8132. All right. So getting into our conversation, I'm going to back up just a little bit. So where would be the best place in the state to grow something like Brussels sprouts? Would that be in Cusharum, where it's a higher mountain valley, or Randolph, or is there season long enough to be able to even grow them? I mean, it sounds like it'd be great for the summer.
Yeah. If you look at where the commercial Brussels sprouts are grown in the U.S., they are grown in Marin County, California, along the coast where you have, ready, warmish day temperatures, coolish night temperatures, kind of humid, a little bit more moist because the ocean is right there. And the day-to-night fluctuation isn't that great, okay? So, at north of San Francisco, south of San Francisco, coastal regions, maybe down as far as Salinas. That kind of is a region where predominantly the Brussels sprouts are grown. There's a few other places out on Long Island in New York, surprisingly, you would think, almost out at the Hamptons, which is one of the richest communities on the eastern seaboard, resort community. But there are farmers there that grow them because, once again, what kind of conditions do you have? You have the ocean surrounding an island, and it never gets too hot and it never gets too cold. So if you think about the state of Utah, where are places like that, where you get reasonably warmish days, coolish nights, and we've got some type of more humid type conditions? We just don't have that.
Yeah, you get to the more humid part, especially. And
I'm like, yeah, so I have a friend here in the valley, and he grows Brussels sprouts every year. He's really likes them. And, we've spent time over the years talking about Brussels sprouts and how to be effective. He grows them quite well in Providence. But he says it's a little bit of a challenge because there are days when it's just too hot and nights when it's just too warm. And so you run into, kind of this stronger flavor to them. But interestingly enough, most of the plants don't really start to produce and fill out the sprouts until, starting late August. And so, you won't really consume that crop maybe until sometime in October. And, well, we know what October is like here, right? The days aren't very warm. The nights are getting down toward the freezing point already. We maybe already had some frost. And it's those types of conditions. The plants are suited and quite tolerant to the cold conditions that builds up the sugar content in those sprouts. And therefore, the bitterness that you would expect to see doesn't happen. Now, something like cauliflower, maybe some of our summer broccolis tend to have a little bit stronger flavor because what's going on, the heading process in the cauliflower and the broccoli is occurring in July and August when it's our hottest period of the year, and then it takes on some of these off flavors. And so the only way for us to get around those things is, well, I can't really garden in Cusharum, if I live here in Logan, so I have to do it in my own garden. So what can I do to try and, meet some of the requirements of those plants? Ideally, I want to keep my soils cooler so that the plant doesn't have to work very hard to get water up into the plant. So I'm going to mulch heavy and do those types of things. I'm going to make sure that I give the plant sufficient water because it's usually stress compounds form when the plant's under water stress as much as heat stress. And so I don't want it to be under both water stress and heat stress. I want it to be one or the other, and preferably not the water stress. So
The heat you don't have as much.
And I don't have any control over the heat. Now, some people would say, put it in a shadier spot and some of those kinds of things. Well, the leaves start to come pretty quick and you still got to grow the plant. So you really need it in full sun for a long time and then put shade later. And it's really too much work to maybe go out and put shade cloth over top of these things.
Does a floating row cover, would that help?
Doesn't really help that much. So
keep the butterflies out about it.
Yeah. But. And that's a nice thing. So what do? You just, try to create an environment that meets most of the requirements for it. So you're going to keep it moist. You're going to keep it well fed, keep it weeded so that it's not under competition stress. And then you're going to just have to cope with what Mother Nature throws at us in terms of temperatures. And if it's cooler, it's probably a good year. If it's hotter, maybe not so good.
Well, and even these higher mountain valleys, they may only have
Well, that's
good growing conditions in the summer, but then they have shorter growing season overall, so then it gets too cold on either
end.
And with
something like Brussels sprouts, you need at least 110 to 125 days somewhere for the earliest maturing types. You know, you could plant them out, you know, about a month ago, but it's been pretty cold. So, you know, people that have put things out early sometimes have said, well, you know, it's not really growing. It hasn't done very much. The plants don't look very well. They have kind of this purple tone to them. Well, you know, the plant's under some cold stress, and those are symptoms of that stress. And so, you know, with sprouts anyway, you know, it's maturing way into September and October and November, and the few times that I've grown them, you know, I just leave them out in the garden, and, you know, by the end of the year, they're nice, they're sweet, you know, very tasty, so they can easily be grown here.
I was looking at some of the things that I wanted to grow in my own garden, and one of the questions I got last night with this group of women in North Logan was, well, how do you keep your cucumbers from being bitter? And I'm thinking it's probably related to not the heat stress, because cucumbers like the heat, but more of the water stress.
Well, it's probably both, you know, because they do have, you know, kind of this upper temperature threshold. And then when you combine it with some water stress, I mean, you look at the surface area of a melon or a cucumber or a squash, it's got lots and lots of leaves, and a lot of, you know, that is where the water is being lost by the plant. It requires a lot more water than most people think. And so if you can keep it better hydrated, you're going to do a lot better. You know, we had quite a few cucumbers we were growing last summer as part of a, you know, kind of, I use it for my class in the fall, and no one complained at all about bitterness in the cucumbers. But, you know, we tend to water like the plant needs to be watered, and we're using sensors to tell us, oh, yeah, it needs to be watered. And so the plants never were under any stress and never had any bitterness either. And then there are also some varieties, and that's once another thing to look for. If you've been growing a variety year after year and you've always thought that they've been bitter, maybe this is the time for you to, you know, look for a different variety. And there are types that have less bitterness to them. And then the second thing beyond that is that your tongue and my tongue taste things differently. Mm-hmm. And so if there's someone there that says, well, you know, I think cucumbers are bitter, they probably think all cucumbers are bitter, regardless of whether they've been or not, because they have more of the bitter taste buds that maybe, you know, they may be more reactive to the compounds that are in those things. And so there are these differences that are care. It's not just how we grow the crop. It's not just the crop that we're growing varietal-wise, but there are also the human parameter that has to come into it. And we have, you know, what I think might be sweet, you might not think is sweet.
It's really interesting you say that. I'm reading a book called How Carrots Won the Trojan War.
Mm-hmm.
And each chapter is about a different vegetable. And I got to the part about beets. And there's a chemical, a compound of some kind in beets that humans are just super sensitive to. You know how a dog has this really good nose? Well, for some reason, we have evolved to just be really sensitive to this, and some people are more sensitive
than
others. And it's the same compound that after it rains, that just the soil smells really good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's just so many parts per billion that we can smell it, and it's fine, but it gets concentrated in beets,
and
it's not so good for some people because they're more sensitive to it.
And that's exactly right, you know. And
I love beets, so I don't have as many of
them. That's probably right, and I love beets too, so, you know, it's not a problem for me, but I know a lot of people that don't like them, and they don't like a lot of things. And you know, you can train yourself to get used to them, but that doesn't change your physiology. You still, you know, can taste that it's strong. You still don't like the some of the flavor compounds that are there. You know, you don't like that bitterness that comes in with this crop. And so you need to kind of know these things. And interestingly enough, we know them. The plant community knows them, and certainly the plant breeders know these things. And so they're looking for ways to try and mitigate that so that, you know, you can enjoy a cucumber. You may like cucumbers, but, you know, you don't like them when they're bitter. And so look for something that has less of those bitter compounds in them, and that's a good way to get around it.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. We only have about 18 minutes in the program so if you would like to get in a question or comment, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can also send an email question, zestygarden@gmail.com. So there's two things I'd like to get to before we finish up. So the first one, again, revolves around the heat question, because when you're planting seeds that are small, they're going to dry out. The ground will dry out faster and affect those more than those with large seeds, because usually the larger the seed, the deeper you plant it.
Yep.
So carrots. You're putting in carrots, and you may be putting them in this Saturday, and if it's really warm, that ground's going to be drying out pretty fast. So what can you do to make sure that your carrot crop comes up?
Well, yeah, there's a couple things that you can do, and one of them is, ensure that you have a really fine seed bed so that you have good contact of the seed to the soil, and so that can absorb the moisture that's there. Generally, sowing depth for carrots might only be a quarter of an inch deep. Maybe you could get away with a half an inch, so that's probably on the deepest end. And then what you want to do is make sure that soil is reasonably moist, and then you need to mulch it heavily. And that seems counterintuitive, but what you're really trying to do is minimize the evaporation of the water off the surface of that where that seed is located. So putting, grass clippings or straw or a floating row cover or something else over top of that bed so that the water doesn't evaporate so quickly will allow that seed to stay in a moist environment so that the germination can proceed with it. Second problem that we have with carrots is that they take a long time to germinate. They might take up to 14 days under really, really good conditions, the appropriate temperature and the appropriate moisture. Well, we never really have the ideal conditions in our garden. We always have less than ideal or, more than the ideal temperature or moisture content. It's either too wet or too dry, never quite perfect. And so you're trying to create the perfect environment, so mulching can do that. One technique that we recommend for the summer is take a piece of plywood, maybe as wide as you want your bedding area to be. I usually suggest, we have these scrap pieces of plywood, maybe a foot or a foot and a half wide, and grow a bed of carrots. So you put your seed out, work your seed bed up, get your fertilizer, do all the things that you need to do, a nice fine seed bed, sprinkle your seeds across the surface, and then stick this piece of plywood right on top of the soil and press it in. So that will create the seed pushing into the soil so that it can get moist. You've got your soil moist as well, and the board then acts as a heat sink, and so it absorbs heat and holds heat into the environment, but it doesn't allow the water to evaporate away. And then what you need to do is just be watching for that, and if you know, and I'll tell the listeners, start at about 14 days after you've seeded the crop. Go out there and look and start to look for the little seedlings. And you need to know what the seed leaves of a carrot look like. They're kind of long, skinny, and pointed.
Looks like a tiny little fern coming up almost.
It kind of does, yeah.
Or parsley leaf.
Yeah, but most people, that doesn't maybe mean anything to them. But you have to kind of go out and look. And as soon as you start seeing those early ones starting to germinate and emerge, then what you do is you can prop up the board, in other words, lift it up so that it's not completely removed, but so that the air can start to move underneath there and start to dry out that, the plants can start to, fill out as you need them.
So maybe put a large, a rock at one
end.
Yeah,
what I do is prop it up, and so if you know which way, you want it so that the north is open and the south is closed, if you think about it that way. So it's on an angle, maybe a 45-degree angle, but so that the sun doesn't directly go to the soil surface and maybe burn off those young little seedlings.
Except only in the morning or the late afternoon.
Yeah, you could take it off or shade it or something like that. So, you know, that works good to get those plants up because they do take an awful long time to come up and, you know, it's somewhat problematic. And we hate to go out and kind of constantly put a little bit of water on the soil surface. And the reason we don't like that is that, yeah, we keep the moisture levels there, but we also, our soils are so prone to crusting that, you know, it just doesn't want to germinate as well. And so it's better to get the profile moist, put the board down, and then use that as your technique. And that's a nice way in the garden because you can do a reasonably small area or large area depending on the leftover plywood that you may have around.
With carrots, I kind of like mixing a little bit of peat moss in that top layer of the soil, and that seems to help hold a little bit of moisture as well.
Yeah, and it also, when you do resprinkle it, it doesn't tend to dry out as much. It needs a fairly fine mist, and it may need that, mm-hmm. you know, like every day for, you know, 10 or 15 minutes only, just to keep it moist if you do have it exposed. But I found that the board system works reasonably well for me, and I get plenty of plants because when you're kind of scattering them, you kind of overseed anyway. And so it's a good way to do it.
Well, we have a caller. We have Ilona from Logan. Hi, Ilona. Thanks for calling.
Hi, yeah, and thanks for your program. It's really great. And I just have a question about challenging things to do. I decided to grow blueberries last year, and we planted them. I've got 6 plants, and we planted them surrounded by sphagnum peat moss, and I've been feeding them soil sulfur to acidify the soil a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And amazingly, this spring it looks like the plants are doing well. So I'm wondering if there's anything you can tell me about encouraging good fruiting and just for the benefit of the plant in general.
Yeah, well, we do have a publication online about trying to grow blueberries under our conditions. It's not you have selected the most challenging of challenges for yourself. So I applaud you for that.
Well, maybe it's just nuts.
yeah, it is kind of nuts because, you know, they just don't really do that well here because our soils are so rich in calcium and our pHs are so high and blueberries really like the soil pH to be around 5. And
right.
It's just so hard for us to kind of get it down to that level that I think what you'll find is that the plants survive, but they maybe aren't going to be very productive.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, be that as it may, I don't really understand why many of our nurseries still sell blueberries, but they do.
Because they can get away with it.
Yeah, well, because people will buy them this year, and then they'll come back next year and buy another one.
Well, because they think, ooh, blueberries, I want to do that.
Yeah, and so what you're doing is right. You know, you want to make sure that you kind of create and add acidifying things to the environment. So things like if you can find a place that has lots of pine needles.
Oh, yeah, great.
Pine needles are acidifying, so go in and just don't put the pine needles down. If you can figure out a way to chop them up, you know, run them through your lawnmower or if you have a chipper or something like that so that the particles are a lot finer.
Grinder, yeah.
Yeah, just grind them up and stick those around the base of them and then, you know, continue to feed with your sulfur
mm-hmm.
will work. But you have to remember that our soils, because we have so much calcium in our soil, it creates the calcium gets bound, and so the pH doesn't go down as far as you want it. And your soil pH is probably 7.5, I would imagine. And so you need to get it down to 5, and that's, you know, like changing something almost 500 times.
Right.
And that's a huge change because one pH unit is like an order of magnitude. So it's a hard process to move it, you know, 2.5 pH units.
Right.
So just keep at what you're doing and then watch those plants. This year, you probably wouldn't get much off them if you established them last year. They probably will flower a little bit, but not very much. And then next year, if they make it through the winter, that's the other problem. You know, sometimes our winters are just so hard on them, and they aren't as hardy as you think they're going to be. Plus, they due to the fact that our soils are the way they are, all of those things kind of are working against you.
Okay.
Now, I know Merv Weeks out at Berries of Paradise has some, but he's growing them in peat soil. He makes up his own
soil.
And
their soil. pH is a little, not and a lot, pH but it's is, a little lower.
It's a little lower, and then he's constantly adding sulfur to his. And
it's
so,
yellow. The soil is yellow. There's so
yeah,
much sulfur.
He's got so much sulfur in it. I mean, so the little that you think you're adding, you could probably double or triple that, and you'd still be okay.
I've been pretty much pouring it in.
Okay, well, then you're doing the right thing. So just keep that up and call us back in the fall and tell us how you've done.
Okay, do you recommend, like, should I put more sphagnum peat moss in, like, regularly? Or?
Yes. Yes, because it's okay. Acid. Yeah, I know that's the thing. You've got to add as much acidy stuff as you can get. So anything that's got acid characteristics to it, you know, that's where the either pine bark or, you know, chipped pine needles or sphagnum moss and then your sulfur, all of those things will help. Okay. Even a little bit of, you know, if you can get some hydrochloric or sulfuric acid or any of those acids and then, you know, add that so that you dilute it down and put that in as your water source, that helps to acidify that soil as well. But you got to be really careful with your concentration.
I was going to say, I don't want to burn them.
Well, you will, but if you dilute it, you know, and I don't know, I'd have to go back and look at what kind of dilutions you'd want, but, you know, it would be, maybe you can find it online, you know, how many ounces to a gallon will you need to add of this in order to have a certain pH in the solution?
Right.
And
okay.
So then you can add water that maybe has a pH of 5.5, and that's what you irrigate them with. And that means you have to hand irrigate, but you don't have that many plants. You could probably do that. And
okay.
You have to do that on a weekly basis, and that will just create more of an acid environment and allow those plants to do well. And in the home garden, maybe you want to go to those extraordinary lengths. Commercially, it's always not such a possible thing because of the vast amount of space that we have to acidify.
Sure.
All right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Alona.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Only about 7 minutes left in the program. If you want to get in a question or comment, since Dan won't be in here again until next month, you better call 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or send us an email question, zestygarden@gmail.com. All right. So in this last few minutes, I just got to get this in. You're the world expert on asparagus.
Yep.
And I've had two people ask me questions about how do I get a really good asparagus bed in? And so I would explain to them. I thought, you're here. I'm just going to have you tell them. I said, tune in and listen to the program.
Well, I think the key thing is to start with good plant material. So getting good varieties and the ones that you really want to grow are some of the Jersey varieties. So Jersey Knight, Jersey Gem, Jersey Jewel,
Jersey Giant.
Centennial is also one of those.
That's the one I've got. I love it. Absolutely love it.
Yeah. Okay. So those are better varieties. If you have anything that says Mary Washington, Martha Washington, Brock's, whatever, you know, those varieties are 100 years old and they perform like, no offense to our older listeners, old people. They just are not very vigorous. They're not very productive. They don't function very well. So if you can stay away from those, great. Establishment should occur in April. You could probably get by with it yet this late, but that's okay. You want to kind of dig a deep trench about 8 or 9 inches deep.
So about a shovel's depth?
Yeah, or a little deeper than that, actually. Deeper the better. So 8 to 10 inches deep is where you want the top of the crown to be. You want to put some phosphate fertilizer down in the bottom of that or something that has a lot of phosphorus in it, but not nitrogen. So you don't want a complete fertilizer. You really want the phosphate down in there because the phosphorus helps the root system grow.
It's pretty cheap, too.
It is. It's not hard. You know, you can find these high phosphate fertilizers. So put that and blend that down in the bottom and then plant your crown and then cover the asparagus with about 2 or 3 inches of soil. So you're going to have a deep trench, but you're only going to backfill it about 2 inches. And then you're going to wait for the spears to start to come up this year, and they're going to start to elongate. And then over the course of the summer, you're going to put in about every 6 weeks, you're going to add in 2 more inches of soil so that by September, you're back to a level, flat garden area. If you take all the soil that you remove from the trench and throw it back in the hole where that crown is, nothing will come up because the plant doesn't produce enough energy and have enough energy to push mm-hmm. the spear all the way up through all that soil. And then you're just going to let it sit this year. You're going to water it about every other week, and you're going to give it a good soaking, but you're not going to water it every day like you do, like most people do their garden, or every other day. You water it every other week, and you do that until the first week of September, and then you stop watering it. And so if you do that, then you're going to start to allow that plant to explore the soil and grow a big root system. You're going to repeat that again next year. You're going to just let it grow. You're going to just water it, maybe give it a little bit of fertilizer.
So let everything grow. Let all the ferns grow.
Yeah, all that happens. So you're going to do that for 2 years, and then 2 years from now, effectively, you're going to start harvesting a little bit. And then you should... that should establish your bed for you. And once you get it established, then you can expect the asparagus bed to last for 15 to 20 years.
And do you need to ever add phosphorus again?
A little bit periodically. Mostly you're going to be putting nitrogen in. The interesting thing about the asparagus plant is you kind of want to front-end load the fertilizer into the system because the plant stores all of its energy in its root system. And we've done some calculations in the crop. If you harvest a lot of asparagus, like a commercial farm off of it, you may only be shipping off of the field 50 pounds of nitrogen each year, about 20 pounds of phosphorus, and about maybe 30 to 35 pounds of potassium. Yet in the root system, you have 300 or 400 pounds of nitrogen, about an equal amount of phosphorus, and about an equal amount of potassium stored in the root system. So the plant is really, kind of loads itself up, and then it kind of feeds it off as you remove those spears. And we recycle a lot of it anyway because all the ferns stay in the garden after you cut them. So most of the nutrients are right there. So the amount that you actually have to put on every year is pretty small. But it's important during the early years when you're growing the plant, before it gets to be fully mature, that you keep it well fed. And then in the later years, you don't need to feed it as much.
So once your bed is established,
you're pretty good.
You pick everything,
and
for it until approximately when?
Usually about the 10th of June or something like that. We're going to pick till the 10th of June this year.
So even the small stuff, pick the small stuff.
Everything that comes up.
And then after then, you
leave everything to grow.
Okay.
We do have a fact sheet on our extension website, so go to extension.usu.edu, and then in under publications. You can then, once you get to publications, there's a search box, and just type in asparagus or type in wasabi or type in whatever, and you will find the information that you want right there.
Okay. Dan, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost, USU Extension Vegetable Specialist, has been my guest. Stay tuned for The Zesty Garden next week at 10 o'clock on Thursdays.
This is Utah Public Radio. KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSUFM HD1 91.5 Logan.